mapping of the negative U-Hubbard model to some kind of a version of a positive U-Hubbard model. Actually, I'll add one more term here just to make life interesting. In the negative U-Hubbard model, I define the hopping term, CIS, CJS, plus emission conjugate. And then I defined the attractive interaction U sum over N I minus 1 squared, the chemical potential. And let me add also some V term, nearest neighbor repulsion. That's because I can think of a situation where if I put two electrons on the same site and they share a polarization, they attract. But if they're on neighboring sites, then they don't share a polarization and they repel because of Coulomb interaction. So just adding an extra term that doesn't cost us anything in terms of complexity, and it has some additional physics in it. The mapping, as you remember, taking spin down and doing a particle Hall transformation, map this problem into a positive U-Hubbard model. Where the hopping term has this funny minus sign between the upspins and downspins, the interaction just reverses sign. The chemical potential turns into a magnetic field because Ni goes into Ni up minus Ni down, plus a constant that I don't care about, but that's a coupling to a spin, not to a density anymore. And this, again, this turns into spin-spin interaction, factor of 2. So there's plus 4V, sum over ij, Szi, Szj. This new Hamiltonian has particle Hall transformed operators. So the meaning of the operators in the context of the original electrons has to be discussed. But this model mathematically is something that we know how to treat already at large U. At small U, again, there's techniques, perturbation theory that I, Fermi liquid type perturbation theory one could use, but I want actually to use the mapping at large U. Now, remember we did the positive U-Hubbard model at large U exactly at half filling, and I told you if you go away from half filling, you're in deep trouble. The positive U-Hubbard model away from half filling is the famous problem called the doped antiferromagnet, or the when you change the filling from one electron per site, this is not a Mott insulator anymore. They're mobile holes and they mess up the spins, and that's a big problem. And we don't know, this course doesn't deal with how to solve it. There's lots of work being done on that in the context of high temperature superconductors, but we only discussed exactly half filling. So the question is, this positive U-Hubbard model, what filling it is? Last time I told you, well, if U is very large, then N really wants to be 1. That's half filling. But what about the other terms? What about this term? And what about such terms? And I told you to try to prove it, but I'll do it for you, that it's actually at half filling for all U. It's exactly at half filling. This is an important point. Because if it wasn't exactly at half filling, then I wouldn't be able to use my canonical transformations, my renormalization that I did from the charge problem to a purely spin problem. So my aim is actually to take this model and throw away the fermion operators and be left only with spin operators. Here I see a little bit of spin operators here, but I have here charge and I have here fermions with their statistics, and reducing it to a Heisenberg-like model. It's not going to be exactly the Heisenberg model. It's going to be a variant of it. That's the topic of what I'm going to do now. So the question is, what filling is it? So I really want to study the question of what is the value of Ni minus 1 with such a Hamiltonian. In other words, I want 1 over Z trace ni minus 1 e to the minus beta h for any temperature, for any in general. And I'd be able to prove that this is exactly 0, then I know that ni minus 1 on the average is exactly 0. Sum over I, if I want. Okay, how do I prove it's exactly 0? And again, I use a trick of canonical transformation. Now, the canonical transformation I'm going to use is a bit confusing, but it's good to know these tricks. You take ci up, and you turn it into a ci down dagger. You take ci down and turn it into a ci up dagger. So it's a particle Hall transformation and a spin flip. Okay? So this is a transformation. Is it canonical? Well, we know that turning a C to a C dagger is canonical. It conserves the commutation rules. Changing the up spin to down spin is just changing of a label. So that's a unitary transformation, and it's also canonical. So you can easily verify that these new operators have the same anti-commutation as these operators with respect to I and J on different sides and I on J on the same side and so on. So this is canonical. Okay, so with this transformation, what happens to the different terms? So I just have to list all the possible operators and what happens to them. So first of all, what happens to the density operator? So density operator ni, which is ni up plus ni down, goes to, well, the down goes, the up goes to down, the down goes to up, according to this prescription. N goes to 1, n up goes to 1 minus n down. And ni down goes to 1 minus ni up, so it becomes 2 minus n. That's a transformation that ni does. What happens to sz? Sz is ni up minus ni down. So there'll be a 1 minus ni down, a 1 minus ni up. But, interestingly, because I flipped the downspin to upspin, I'll get this is exactly the same operator. It's actually invariant under this transformation because the 1s cancel out, and I change the order of up to down, so the minus ones from the particle Hall transformation get canceled. What's the next one? Let's look at the, okay, so we know what this does, we know what this does, they stay invariant. This ni minus 1 goes to 2 minus n minus 1, so it goes to 1 minus ni. So ni minus 1 flips sign. So the u term is invariant because it's ni minus 1 squared. It's positive. So the only thing left is to look at this complicated kinetic term. And what happens to t, the kinetic term? Minus t sum over I ci cj up up minus ci cj down down. I'll do the particle transformation. This goes to ci down dagger, this goes to cj down. It's the same on all. Sorry, this is not a dagger. This goes without a dagger. And this goes to a dagger. And this guy, and there's a minus, this guy goes to ci up, no dagger, cj. Sorry, why am I saying, yeah, this goes to ci up, no dagger, cj up with a dagger. Okay, that's the transformation. Now I just want to normal order it. Normal ordering is putting all the daggers on the left and the non-daggers on the right, and that becomes, because these guys are on different sides, they just anti-commute, give you a minus sign, so I get a cj down ci down with a minus sign because of the anti-commutation. And this is a ci up, cj, cj up, ci up, dagger. So this is a sum over all ij, and it has, of course, the terms ij and also the term ji. That's the hopping matrix element. Notice what I got from this transformation is simply the term ji. So t goes to t. So what happened to the Hamiltonian? Nothing. This guy came back to itself. This guy came back to itself. This guy came back to itself because it's SZ. This guy's SZ as Z came back to itself. So Hamiltonian, this kind of a positive U Hamiltonian, came back to itself under this transformation. Okay, so go back to what we try to calculate. We try to calculate this object. Now we did the transformation, a canonical transformation. Trace, okay, if I do a canonical transformation on a trace, the trace stays the same, except now it's counting the new variables. But what this does is 1 over z trace e to the minus beta h, where it's the same beta h as I proved. So this guy stayed the same, but ni minus 1 turned into 1 minus ni. So I got an equation between ni minus 1 and 1 minus ni. And of course, if an object is equal to minus itself, it has to be equal to 0. So I proved that for all variables in this problem, mu, v, u, t, it's always at half filling. So the negative U-Hubbard model always goes to the positive U-Hubbard model at half filling. That's a great simplification. Okay? And why is it simplifying? Because, as we show, if we know that the system is at half filling and we take U to be large, we'll be able to do the mapping to a spin model. Yes? SZ doesn't change, so mu doesn't. SZ is invariant. It's true, if you looked at this guy, you'd think it's going to change. But remember, when we did the transformation for the positive, we lost the density. We changed it into spin. Okay, so now all I have to do is do the transformation of large negative u, this Hamiltonian, at large negative, large u now, and ask what kind of a spin model do I get? Do I get the Heisenberg model or something similar but not exactly the same? And we get something not exactly the same. So this is large u. Now I put u in a, because u is negative, so I put it in a absolute value, u over t, h twiddle plus u goes to an effective Hamiltonian, H effective, that essentially lives in the space of singly occupied new kind of electrons, okay? Let's call them singly occupied fermions, n equal to 1. And I do exactly the same calculation we did last time to get the effective Hamiltonian. I get the second order term that will take care of the effects of T. So remember that when we calculate the second order terms, first of all, we have the Hamiltonian without the T term. The Hamiltonian without the T term in the lowest order, in the lowest subspace, is the u ni minus 1 squared expectation value. U ni minus 1 expectation value is 0 because ni is equal to 1. Then I'll have minus 2 mu sum over I s z I. That's not 0. That counts the spin magnetization in the singly occupied subspace. And then I have the other spin term, 4v sum over ij sz sz. And these are all just the expectation value of the Hamiltonian in the lower subspace. And then I get from the integrating out of the higher subspace, I get the second order term, which is of order t squared over u. And it has this kind of a sum over super exchange paths, if you remember. Things that look like ci, cj, minus ci, cj, up, up, down, down, times cj, ci, minus cj, ci, up, up, minus down, down. And notice before we had pluses and now we have minuses. That's the only difference between the super exchange calculation we had before. And then there's, of course, a factor of two because I do I goes to j and also j goes to I. So there's a factor of two here. And all I want to show is that what happens in this transformation, of course, is in a subspace where there's no double occupied sites, except here in the center, after I occupied the j site with these daggers, I'll make it double occupied because I'm acting on a single occupied state. So remember what the calculation last time. The calculation was writing these four fermion operators, rearranging them, commuting them, and getting SZ, SZ, S plus, S minus, S minus, S plus. This was the projector 1 minus PS, which is essentially NJ is equal to 2. Projector onto double occupied site on J. It's the high energy space that gives us the denominator U. Actually, let me think about the sign. I got a minus sign from the fact that the energy denominator was E minus mu. That's a minus sign. Okay. So, so remember what are the terms that you get here. You get this kind of term up, up, and then up, up. That comes with a plus sign. There's also a down, 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 down. That comes with a minus. This is I, J, J, I, J, J, I. That's these two terms. And then there's a cross term, but they appear, that's the new stuff now, they appear with a minus sign. So the up, down, or the up, up, down, down, plus down, down, up, up, they have a relative minus sign. I, J, J, I, J, J, I. Okay. Now remember the trick last time. This, when you anti-commute, you don't get a 1 because it's up and down. You'll get essentially C dagger up, C down, C dagger down, C up. So this becomes, there's a minus sign here, so it becomes plus, S minus, this is actually S plus, S minus S plus IJ. This becomes plus S plus S minus IJ. Okay? These guys, on the other hand, when you anti-commute, you get, first of all, a 1 because it gives you a 1 minus density of J and up. So this becomes, okay, so I'm writing these two terms here, and this term becomes N up, with a minus sign, because I changed the order, IJ, and then I have another constant, which is plus N up, NI up. The other guy will give me minus NI down, NJ down, plus NJ, and Ni down. Okay. Now, when you sum over I and J, you'll also get the term with Nj. Okay. I'll get a factor of half because I took the two already out. So eventually, you just get Ni divided by 2, and here you have an Ni divided by 2 for the Ni, sorry. This guy will give me Ni up plus Nj up, and this give me Nj up, Ni up, divide by 2, so I'll get Ni plus, okay, I'll collect the terms afterwards. It's just not helping anything. This is just Ni up and Nj up, and then do the collection like that. Ni down. Okay, so now this guy and this guy, I use always the trick minus Ni up plus Ni up Nj up plus Ni down Nj down, and I write it as Sz Sz plus N dot N, because this is equal to 2 Sz I Sz J, because that's Ni up minus Ni down, and plus Ni dot Nj, it's actually 4. So this expression here is simply this expression here, over a minus sign, and then I have this plus Ni plus Nj divided by 2. Okay, so if I sum up everything, I can write down the result, and it looks like this. The important thing to remember is that between the S plus S minus and the SZ as Z, there's a relative minus sign we didn't have before. Before, because we didn't have these minus signs, these came with the same sign, the same minus sign as SZSZ. But now they come with a plus. There's an overall minus sign. So the bottom line is a model that I called the minus XZ model. It's 4 T squared over U. Sum over IJ with a plus sign. SZI SZJ minus SXI SXJ minus SIY SJY. So it's a funny Heisenberg model where there's minus signs in the XY plane and a plus sign in the Z direction. There's a 4V, another contribution to the Ising term. And there's a 2 mu sum over I S Z. So what is this model? It's a Heisenberg-like model with anisotropy in the Ising term that I added, as I said, due to physical reasons, in a magnetic field. Yes. No. I'm going to discuss the meaning of the operator soon. Just want to look at the model without thinking about the meaning. The model is familiar to you, more or less, except for the minus signs. And putting a magnetic field on the Heisenberg model may be something we haven't thought about before, but it's not a big deal. And it has a bit of isotropy in the Ising direction. And this is a model that applies essentially to all fillings. If I go to the original negative U-Hubbard model, the filling comes into the effective magnetic field. So if I was at half filling in the original model, let's say my negative U-Hubbard model was average of 1 electron per site, this mu would be 0. And you'll just have the pure XXZ model. Question, these minus signs, are they important or not important? Well, on bipartite lattices, lattices that you could separate into two lattices such that each bond connects sublattice A to B, I can get rid of this minus sign by rotation. So if lattice is bipartite, then I have two sublattices A connecting to B and B connecting to A. I can do a spin rotation. In other words, I could send SZ to SZ, SX to minus SX, SY to minus SY for every I on sublattice B. So if I have a, let's say, a spin direction, the Z, this is X, this is Y. A sublattice rotation is a unitary transformation where you just rotate the spin by pi around the z-axis. If you rotate the spins by pi around the z-axis, sx goes to minus sx, sy goes to minus sy, but sz stays the same. That's just a rotation. So if I rotate my convention, so only convention is where I decide the x and the y directions to be on sublattice B, then what will happen is this will turn to minus, this will turn to minus, and the plus signs will go away, and the Hamiltonian will be transformed to the usual Heisenberg antiferromagnet with SZ, SZ, plus SY, SX, SX, plus SY, SY. These terms will stay the same because SZ doesn't change. And this term also will stay the same because SZ doesn't change. So if that model looks a bit more simpler to understand, because now you say, oh, this just wants to align these spins antiferromagnetically in an EL state. Now, immediately we can start discussing what kind of phases this model gives. That's the whole advantage of what we did before with the spin coherent states. You put this model in a spin coherent states, and all these operators get changed into vectors, unit vectors. What do unit vectors want to do if you give them this kind of an energy? They want to anti-align on the two sublattices, be antiferromagnetic. They would prefer, if V is positive, to be in the Z direction, because then they will get minus V, it's actually minus four times V for every bond. And here they'll get some force T squared over U for every bond, and these guys won't matter. And then the question is, what does the magnetic field do? Magnetic field doesn't want them actually to be anti-parallel, because if they're anti-parallel, the magnetization is zero, and you don't gain, if the sum of SZ is zero, you don't gain any energy from here. So you can see immediately that if mu is zero, there's no magnetic field, the system wants to align in the Z direction and form an EL state. So that's something you immediately see is happening. So before we start discussing the phase diagram, I'll discuss the physical meaning of these operators. Yes? What was the effect of the projector? Okay. I used it, actually. I went a bit fast because we did it before for the positive U. What I really assumed in this analysis is that all the states on the right have one electron. So the moment I'm taking and adding an electron, doesn't matter if it's spin up or spin down, it will automatically satisfy this projector, because it will actually pile up two electrons and be in the double occupied state, which is the condition that you need from second order perturbation theory, right? You need to go to the complementary subspace. So that's the condition that gets satisfied, and that's why I can ignore it. I also noticed I dropped all these terms here, because again, when you evaluate them at half filling, they all get just ones everywhere, and all this adds to this just constants, which I'm not interested in. So eventually I'm just left with a spin model, and now I'm at the position of discussing the physical meaning of these spins. And it's very surprising. The physical meaning of these spins, actually, I think, is really the essence of understanding what a superconductor is. A superconductor and a system of paired electrons. So let's discuss that. Yeah.
So first, just remind me what the bipartite is.
Bipartite means a lattice, like a square lattice, honeycomb lattice, cubic lattices, which you could divide into two sublattices, A and B.
So like A and B.
And the bonds, it's actually not a property of the geometry of the lattice, it's a property of the bonds you put on the lattice. And if I put only nearest neighbor bonds, then it becomes a property of the lattice. That all bonds connect only a guy from A to a guy from B, and never a guy from A to A or from B to B. That's called bipartite. Okay? Tripartite is the same thing with three sublattices. A triangular lattice is tripartite, because every A can connect either to B or to C. And it's very important for antiferromagnets to be in a bipartite. Well, not important, but if you're in a bipartite situation, antiferromagnets have a very simple solution. Put all the spins in one direction on A and the opposite direction on B. But if it's not bipartite, then you have frustration. Okay? These are things I repeat. This is the next, this is the nearest neighbor repulsive interaction I added to the negative U-Hubbard model to make it more interesting. Okay, this actually, you can add this 4V to 4T squared over U and get the coupling JZ, which is a bit different than the coupling in the XY direction. That's right. It's the same term. It's just coming from different places. This shows manifestly that if you didn't have this next nearest neighbor interaction, the system would have O3 symmetry. Okay? But in general, you don't expect it to have O3 symmetry. Also, once you put the magnetic field, you destroy the O3 symmetry. You choose a direction, and the system loses its SU2 or O3 and just becomes O2. It still has a symmetry in the XY plane. Yes? Yes?
It's not only the SX spin, but also the XY spin that has a negative sign in front of it.
Yeah, you do a pi rotation, you flip X and Y. X, Y, yeah. Okay. So, order parameters. Okay. No, we started with a negative U.
We start with a negative U at half filling, we get a positive U at half filling?
No, we start with a negative U at any filling.
Okay.
And end up with a positive U at half filling.
End up with a positive, okay.
And a positive U at half filling is something we know how to solve at large U over T.
Right.
And then we go to a spin model.
And the particular transformation.
So I'll write it down. We have negative U, any filling. We transformed it to a positive U at half filling. And then large U, it goes into a spin model. Okay? Right. Now we're asking, what are the meanings of these spins?
So yesterday, in order to get from the negative U to the
positive, we just did a particle hole transformation.
Yeah, that's
and
all.
Today we did a particle hole plus a spin flip. That was
no, that was just to prove it's a tie fitting.
Okay.
I didn't transform the Hamiltonian. It was just
right.
It was a proof that I gave. Large U is the same trick as we did before with the Heisenberg, Hubbard to Heisenberg. Okay? So here we are with the spins, and we ask, what are these spins? So SZ, I, right, is really NI minus 1 in the original. This is the original fermions. Or let's call them electrons, so you kind of remember that these are the physical objects. The original electrons, I was measuring their number, the total number in every site, minus 1. And SZ, actually, I divide by 2. SZ is measuring whether, if it's plus a half, it means that I have double occupation. If I have minus a half, I have single occupation. So if you want, the up spin is associated with double occupation, and the down spin is associated with no occupation. Okay? That's easy to understand. So now, if I tell you there's ordering, there's an order parameter in the system, SZI is non-zero. What does that mean? That means that the density is different than 1. So I can define, let's say, sum over I SZI, expectation value, and that is associated with an order parameter in the original system. It's not really an order parameter, it's just the total density. So it's N over 2 minus a half. So N minus 1 over 2. So if N is different, this is N, sorry, small n, expectation value. So if N is different than 1 electron per site, then I have a total magnetization. That's my, if you want, MZ in the pseudo-spin language. But I can have more interesting order parameters. For instance, I can have this fluctuate from site to site. So if I have a configuration that looks like this, then that translates to 0, double, 0, double on the electron side. So this is a charge density wave. That's what is called in solid state physics, a charge density wave. Charge is modulated. Now, the charge density wave doesn't have to be fully polarized, zero upspin, downspin, upspin, downspin. It could also be a little bit upspin, a little bit downspin. For instance, I can have a charge density wave where the spins are doing something like this. Now, this is, of course, writing everything in terms of coherent states. But in a real system with quantum fluctuation, superposition of coherent states, this number could be anything. It could be any number larger than 0. So there is an order parameter, call it M of Q. And M of Q, if you want, is, I'm not writing it anymore in terms of a coherent state. I just want to define it rigorously as an order parameter. So it's the trace of SZI e to the I Q dot XI sum over I expectation value. It's the Fourier transform of the expectation value of SZI with respect to some momentum Q. And if M of Q is non-zero for some momentum Q, that really shows that there is a modulation with that wave vector of the spin. And the spin Z reflects a charge modulation of essentially NI e to the I QXI, same Q, sum over I, that's a CDW at wave vector q. So for the case that I discussed there, that I want to order the spins in the z direction, this will be a pi pi, or pi depending on the dimensionality, CdW, where the charge is modulated. Now the charge can be modulated, just a second, the charge can be modulated around zero or around some average value. So I can think of a charge, a CdW, as some average charge. This is my m, z at zero, and this is my m, z at momentum q. And q is this wave vector. This is 2 pi over q. So you can see that now the modulation of the spins and their average position relate to the density fluctuation. So if I want to draw spins, let's say, that do something like this, I will draw spins that are kind of canted in on average. Okay, this will correspond to the spins are canted on average. There is an average magnetization, but there's also a modulation. So everything is possible. Yes?
The SIZ, the spin up kit and the spin down kit represent, what those two lines represent?
The correspondence between the original electron states and the pseudo spins, they're called, the spins that I defined after the transformation.
And how is that in order for them?
So these guys are called pseudo spins. Yes? Okay, now if you have an expectation value of an operator, right, that's an order parameter. That's what you define as an order parameter. It's a magnetization, staggered magnetization. In this case, you will have a charge density wave. These are order parameters. These are things that represent the phase. You can get them after you, when you take this expectation value, both on the ground state wave function and on the thermodynamic averaging if you have a finite temperature. So what I'm showing now is that the phases of matter that come out from this model, so far we've seen a charge density wave phase. And now we're going to see something else. But charge oscillations are very natural. They'll be like having the spins here in the antiferromagnet pointing in the z direction and having some variable magnetization in space. Okay? Okay, what is ordering in the xy direction? So I'll write the operators down and you'll see. So in the xy direction, okay, sx is s plus plus s minus divided by 2. S plus is ci up, dagger ci down. That's in the pseudosphere. But it corresponds for the electrons. Remember, ci down was a particle Hall transformation. It corresponds to ci down, dagger. It's an operator that creates two electrons out of the vacuum. It creates a Cooper pair. Okay, and the S minus annihilates a Cooper pair. Interestingly, they obey, because they're exactly these S plus, S minus, and the SZ operator, they obey the SU2 algebra. Even if you just looked at these operators and did the anti-commutation relation, you'll find that SZ with S plus minus obeys the SU2 algebra. Of plus minus S plus minus. So that's true for these two operators, and I remind you that SZ was equal to C dagger C I up plus C dagger C I down minus 1 over 2. That was the SZ operator. So these three operators obey the SE2 algebra, simply because of this particle automation, you get an SE2 algebra more easily seen. But they represent a creation, an annihilation of a Cooper pair, and a charge density wave. And they have a relation to it, canonical relations, exactly like SZ does with SX and SY. Yeah.
On the top board, when you wrote down MZ, the pseudo-magnetization in
yeah.
Z direction, shouldn't on the right-hand side be minus the number of sites instead of minus one? If we sub...
Yes, the number of sites to multiply number of sites. Yeah. Okay, so I look at these operators, and of course, operators never tell me anything. It's only their expectation values or their eigenvalues. Eigenstates. So, in order to understand the physical meaning of such a creation operator of a Cooper pair, I should look at what are the eigenstates of, for instance, SX and SY. What do they represent? Yes.
Can I look at the relationship between, so we've been talking a great deal about spins, and now we're talking about charges, charge density.
Yes.
Would you mind explaining the relation?
It's all written there. I don't know. What do you mean, explain the relation? Charge in the original electrons corresponds to direction of spin in the z direction for pseudo electron. Now, in the xy, it's not the same. Charge is not really the point here. It's these C dagger operators. So now I'm explaining exactly what these mean, but in the z direction, it's simple, right? Charge is related to spin. But in this direction, it's a bit different. So what is, for instance, Sx times some operator? Let's put it in a coherent state. Okay, that's why I worked so hard to show you coherent states. So I take the operator Sx and I put it in a coherent state. A coherent state is cos theta over 2 up plus sine theta over 2, e to the I phi, down. So, for instance, Sx in a coherent state is simply cos theta sine, there's a half in front, sine theta. And Sy in a coherent state, it's just the y component of omega, which is cos, wait, did I do something wrong? Sine theta cos phi, and this is sine theta sine phi. And if I look at the state x, omega is equal to x, then theta is equal to pi over 2. So I have here 1 over square root of 2. I have up. And here I have phi equal to 0 because it's in the x direction. So I have plus down. Okay? If I take, okay, so that's in the x direction. Now let me do the correspondence to a physical states. It's 1 over square root of 2, empty site plus double occupied site. So the state that is polarized in the x direction is a superposition of two different charges, 0 and 2. Okay? This superposition comes with a plus sign if it's in the x direction, but it can also, if omega is in the y direction, then the correspondence is 1 over square root of 2 up plus I times down. So now I can put it in a superposition 1 over square root of 2, empty site plus I times double occupied site. So there's a phase here. If I take any direction in the xy plane, omega in the xy plane, it corresponds to 1 over square root of 2, right? This 1 over square root of 2 is both sine and cosine, and then I have empty plus e to the I phi double. So the physical meaning of these different directions in pseudo-spin space have to do with superposition of different charges with phase that could be anything in the xy plane, depending on the direction of the spin in the xy plane. And this is now the kind of building block of what we'll call a superconductor. It's now a place where charge fluctuates, but it doesn't just fluctuate thermally. It fluctuates in a coherent way. There's a superposition of two different charge states with a well-defined phase between them. This phase is very important. All the physics that will come out on superconductivity and superfluidity has to do with the fact that the phase here is well-defined. And it can vary in space, and it can do vortices and interesting stuff. But that's where it comes from, the superposition. Yeah? Phase is just a parameter.
Yeah, just a parameter. Say, right here, the up is associated with the up-down, so it's here.
Well, here, if I wrote down in terms of up and down, this would be the relative phase of down relative to up.
Yeah.
It's exactly like a spin-off. But now, physically, it's not up and down. It's zero and double occupied. Okay.
I mean, we're right there. The up is associated with the double occupied state. So
yes.
For consistency, should this I be associated with the zero?
I flipped the direction of the spin. Okay, you're right. Okay, so this is okay, and all you want is put it this way. Okay, it's just different sign of phi. Okay, so when you have this superposition, you're polarizing the spins in a plane. Now I can talk about all the parameters. If my Heisenberg model that I had here, for some reason, wants to give me spins that look like this, my interpretation immediately is going to be this is a superconductor. This is a case where I have superpositions of different charges at every site in a coherent fashion. The angle, the phases, is constant. Okay, phi is equal to constant. It might be zero. In this case, I just drew it in the xz plane at zero. But it could be rotated anywhere in the plane. It has an average density n minus 1, which is the magnetization. And it has a projection onto the xy plane, which is sine theta, which is the expectation value of c dagger. If it's the x direction, it's plus c, up, down, up. So having an expectation value of a Cooper pair operator creation and annihilation amounts to having a pseudo-spin some projection on the xy plane. So this does not happen if the spins are exactly in the z direction, but the moment they start canting, immediately I get an order parameter that has this expectation value. If you looked at this originally when Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer introduced this as an order parameter for fermions, it was considered the biggest revolution in physics at the time, that one could write down expectation value of an operator that doesn't conserve number of particles. Particle number was considered wholly in condensed matter. You cannot change the number of electrons in a system unless you do something drastic. But an order parameter here doesn't really mean that the whole system is a superposition of many different numbers of electrons. It just means that locally I can define superpositions, rigid superpositions, I call them, between different occupation numbers. And that's the superconducting order parameter. It's the XY projection of these pseudo spins. Yes?
Looks like some of us aren't familiar with Cooper pairs. I can see by looking at the creation of annihilation operators,
a Cooper pair by what I introduced here is the double occupied site, that's all. Okay? That's my definition of Hoover pair in the picture I'm drawing here. Of course, in the real superconductors, Cooper pairs have some finite width. They're not sitting on the same site. They're sitting on some distance scale, which could be several sites. But it's the same idea. It's some region in space is occupied by a singlet, two electrons in the same space with opposite spins. They form a singlet wave function and move together, behave essentially as one object. Now, soon we're going to learn that I can replace this operator by, well, I already replaced this operator with a spin operator, S plus. But the spin operator I can replace with a bosonic operator, and then I have just a boson describing the existence or non-existence of a Cooper pair. So the word Cooper pair is just the correct terminology according to the historical development of the theory. Let's see. So at this point, I can start talking about what does this Hamiltonian give us? Because this Hamiltonian was derived from interacting electrons on a lattice. And a priori, if I look at it and I see that the V is positive, I say, I don't think there's ever going to be a superconductor in this model because the spins want to be in the z direction. Why would they ever want to flip down to the xy plane and give us the superconducting order parameter? And the answer is, quite generally, they want to do that. And I'll show you why. And that's actually the mechanism of superconductivity brought in a very simple way. So why do the spins want to lie in the xy plane in this model? That's the question. And we have all the tools to discuss it. That's why we worked on quantum magnetism. In the tools to discuss it are simply going to be discussing it in coherent states as you would classical Hamiltonians. So essentially, if I put the Hamiltonian in a bunch of coherent states, then what do I have? I have this J omega Z omega Z. This is JZ, sum over IJ. And then I have minus, and I don't want to do the bipartite transformation. I want to really keep the generality here. So I have here, okay, let me actually write it in terms of cosine and phi. So it's cosine theta I, cosine theta J, minus JX, sine theta I, sine theta J, cosine of phi I minus phi J. You're familiar with these kind of expressions, right? And then there's the minus 2 mu, sum of I, cosine theta I. I absorb the size of the spin into J. I absorb it into the field here, H. And I'm essentially looking at this model. This model, classical model, minus x z classical. It's very simple. If I take h to 0 and jz to be larger than jx, then the solution is going to be, as I said before, just an antiferromagnet in this case, if it's bipartite. And now I can ask, what happens if I put a magnetic field on the problem? Will it stay in the z direction? Okay, so imagine I put a magnetic field on this configuration in the h direction. So h couples to the total magnetization. But if I'm in this configuration, the total magnetization is 0. So I increase h. I increase it, and I increase it, and I increase it, and eventually, the energy is not changing at all because this is 0. I'm getting quite frustrated because I put a strong magnetic field and I'm not gaining any energy from it. On the other hand, I can compare it to a different state, which is the state given by having the spins do that. If the spins do that, then they have a component. This is the direction of H. They have a component, mz, which is non-zero. So I can get minus mz minus hmz, reduction in the energy from the magnetic field. I lose this guy, but I gain jx. So the question is, what is the difference between jz and jx? So if jx is the same order as jz, or jx is a little bit smaller than jz, I will still get from here minus jx times sine squared theta energy. And it's a balance of energies. I just have to look at the free energy E as a function of my theta. And it seems like here theta is equal to zero, here theta is equal to some finite number. At a certain point, my energy here, this is E Ising. Ising is this configuration because it's in the Z direction. It's called Ising. And here's this is EXY. This is XY. And there's a level crossing at some critical field, H critical, where the system would actually like to flop, it's called. Turn from the Z direction immediately to the XY direction, give us some energy from the canting, plus not lose too much energy because I'm gaining back from the XY coupling. So as a function of magnetic field H, I'm drawing you the phase diagram. The phase diagram will have some critical value, H critical, where on this side it's going to be XY, and this side it's going to be Ising. So above a certain critical field, the system would like to flop into the plane. Once it flops into the plane, it has no other alternative. It has to give me a XY component. So in terms of the charges, in terms of the electrons, this is a superconductor. And this is a charge density wave. Could be probably an insulator. Because once these charges get localized, double, zero, double, zero, double, zero, you try to move them, you have to cross a gap to put two. You can't put two charges on top of each other, but you can't even move them very much because there's a ordering of the charge. So this is an insulator, superconductor transition as a function of H. But remember, H was just the original 2 mu of the electrons. So if I want to look at this axis is doping the original negative U Hubbard model away from half filling, eventually leads to a superconductor with this Hamiltonian if you overcome the anisotropy between JZ and JX. Yes? This energy goes down because I'm getting more and more from the magnetization, because it's right. This has a magnetization, this space. So minus Hm makes it go down. And when it becomes lower in energy than this energy, then the ground state flips to the ground state of the XY model.
I believe you said earlier, and around the time that you mentioned the word frustrated, as the magnetic field is increased, no energy, the energy.
This
does
guy
not,
doesn't
the
change.
Does not change.
Yeah, that's this guy.
And what precisely is that? It's the energy.
Because this always is zero in that phase.
Yes, why is that zero? I'm guessing it's relating to the angle.
Because in this phase, this spin and this spin are always exactly opposite to the direction of the field. So they cancel the magnetization. The magnetization here is zero. The total magnetization. So when you look at this phase, you immediately see that this phase can't gain anything from the magnetic field. That's why the spins, they want to be here when there's no magnetic field. But when there's a magnetic field, they want to flip and be ferromagnetic because this is negative and have some magnetization. It's called the spin-flop transition. And one can work out in statistical mechanics and in the beginning, I wanted to give it as an exercise, but then Dennis convinced me that you're going to do it next semester or next course. Just do the mean field theory as a finite temperature. It's possible to get the finite temperature phase diagram. I can draw it for you. If you put temperature on one side, this is the zero temperature phase diagram. There's a critical point. The finite temperature phase diagram looks like this. This is the Ising. This is paramagnet. This is no order whatsoever. Here, actually, it looks like this. This is the XY. This is the superconductor. So this is the charge density wave, and this is the superconductor, or Ising XY, depending on what language you like better. This point here is called the bicritical point, because it connects two second-order transitions with the first order. So anybody that these words are for him a foreign language, to just write them down and look at them after next semester. Okay? So these are all transitions that are completely straightforward to get from this Hamiltonian as a function of temperature in a magnetic field. And I explained only the zero temperature transition from superconductor to charge density wave, but there's also finite temperature transitions, which are interesting. At finite temperature, what happens is the sizes of the spins are no longer a half. They can be smaller because of the effects of thermal fluctuations. So for instance, here, you'll have a finite magnetization here because the up spins will be a bit longer than the down spins. So that's the finite temperature effect that you can get. But otherwise, there's not much more logical difficulty in understanding the full phase diagram relative to the zero temperature one. Okay? Yes? Two mu.
Two mu. What is
it? That's the field. Remember, the field was related to the chemical potential of the original electrons?
Okay.
And the chemical potential was doping away from half filling. So there's a possibility here to get a superconductor by just taking less than one electron per unit cell in a system that has a negative attraction. That's all. In fact, there are systems which this model is a very good description of. This phase diagram is observed in systems with strong electron phonon coupling. A good example is barium potassium bismutates. It's a system where if you don't put potassium, barium bismutate is exactly n equal to 1, half filling. And it's a very strong insulator. And the charges are disproportionated into, so there's a charge density wave. If you look at the charge distribution in space, it's a cubic material. There'll be something like 2, 0, 2. Now I'm exaggerating, of course. It's not 2, 0, 2, 0, but it's a little bit above 1, a little bit less than 1 is really what goes on here. But the idea is the charge is disproportionating, and there's a lattice distortion associated with it, so it's observed. So this charge density wave is observed. And then you get quite a high temperature superconductor at doping induced by changing the number of electrons by putting potassium. So this is X. This is 1 minus X. Putting potassium takes away electrons, or puts holes, doesn't matter, goes away from half filling, and gives you a superconductor with TCs up to 40 Kelvin, which was a very high temperature at the time. This material was discovered very shortly before they discovered the cuprate materials. It was understood to be a consequence of strong electron lattice coupling, but the phase diagram really looked like the spin-flop phase diagram. So the negative U-Hubbard model at large U seems to be completely appropriate for this system. Also, the Cooper pairs are very small in size, so the local assumption and the large negative U assumption are all justified. And in fact, you have the same phase diagram. And you can understand the superconductor as simply the pseudo spins falling into the plane, giving you a long range order in the XY plane. The long range order in the XY plane has a word that is associated with it. You'd say it's just long range order in the XY plane, but the word, the definition that you see in the literature for this kind of ordering, it was invented by C.N. Yang. It's called off-diagonal long-range order, rather than just long-range order. Off-diagonal, because the way he understood it came from a more complicated way, looking at the two-particle density matrix. But it's exactly this. Nothing more than just ordering in the XY plane of pseudospins. Okay? Yeah.
Then is if you try to evaluate ESY, then the effect of NZ try to just fit the spin to the XY plane. So.
Yes, but not completely to the XY plane, because you still want to gain energy by having NZ
so
finite.
I'm just confused that.
This curve is not as a function of mz. This is a function of h, of mu, if you want. So up to this point, actually, when you're in this phase, you're not doping the system at all. You're changing chemical potential, but the system is an insulator. It's resistant to the change in chemical potential. It gives you zero doping, zero actual density change. Here, suddenly, the density jumps. Okay, so if you looked at this curve, the density here, if you want n, is equal to 1 throughout this phase. And then here, n is larger than 1. There's a jump. This continues, first order.
So could you please explain the difference between the pseudo spin and the XY? What part of the Hamiltonian is the XY, and so YH is?
Okay, so you take this Hamiltonian and you decide to put the thetas, let's say phi you put to zero, you decide to put the thetas in this picture. Here the thetas go 0, pi, 0, pi, 0, pi, and this will be 0. The other energy is put theta to be finite. Okay, so you have cosine squared of theta here, sine squared of theta here with different coefficients. And here you'll get a term cosine theta. These are the two energies that I'm comparing here. That's called doing a variational calculation of the energy in coherent states. It's also called mean field theory. But since it's zero temperature and it's only an energy and there's no temperature involved, it's simply a variational calculation of the energy. That's all. Yes?
So in comparison, what part is the energy for Ising?
The Ising part is this guy. The XY part is this guy. But the variational calculation is done assuming this Ising configuration and assuming this XY configuration. You see? There's Ising terms and Ising configurations. Yeah, two different things. And I'm just comparing energies to say, what is the ground state going to be like? It's much, much simpler than trying to diagonalize Hamiltonians, right? It's looking at simple functions and finding where they're minimized. Yeah?
So in your answer to one of Yang's questions, it sounded like you said the spin flop is equivalent in the original fermion picture to a jump from an average occupation number of 1 to a higher occupation number.
Yes.
But I thought that in the original fermion picture, we weren't assuming filling. I thought we went from negative U model. With
yes. This is why we have the whole phase diagram. We allow the fermion to be any density here.
But in the picture just to the left?
Yeah. So here it's 1, and here it's different than 1.
Yeah. So I thought
thought there was a progression from n equals 1 to n greater than 1 associated with the spin plot.
Yes, this is it. At this point, the n changes from 1 to a finite number. Or if you want, n is essentially the z component of the spins. It's jumping from 0 to some number.
I'm just wondering why we start out with average occupation number equaling 1, because that sounds like half just, filling to start out with. And I thought
yeah,
that
yeah.
Actually we started out with any filling. So why are we...
No. We started with the Hamiltonian at any filling. And now we started discussing at half-filling and moving away. It's not that we limited ourselves to half-filling for the original Hubbard. The original negative U Hubbard, I said, it's written there, any filling, you see?
Exactly.
And then I'm going back to that any filling and moving it from 1 to larger than 1. That's all. This is a particular limit that is simple, and this is another limit that's simple, and I'm showing how you go. When you dope electrons, real electrons, away from half-filling, you'll get a superconductor. Question is, can you get a superconductor at 1? So, if anybody kind of followed my logic and could give me a reason why somebody would expect a superconductor even at half-filling. Okay? So, you look at the Hamiltonian, either this one, and you can say, can I get a superconductor even when I take this field to 0?
You can have anisotropy in the EC term?
Yes, if I can take this term and make it small, maybe smaller than that. Then, of course, it will always lie in the plane, right? Because this is a ferromagnet in the XY direction. So if JZ is less, right. Now, let's say JZ is not less. It's even larger than JX. Can anybody think of a situation where still it wants to be in the plane? Yes? It's a question or an answer? It looks like you want to ask a question.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
Okay, so you want a hint or you can think about it? Yes?
If it's a number of content.
Exactly. Okay. So when it's non-bipartite, this term, is it going to be frustrated? Imagine a ferromagnet on a triangular lattice. Is it frustrated?
Would you mind just getting frustrated?
Unhappy, like you are now.
Yes.
You want the full definition of frustration? It's not easy. I'll draw a picture and that's enough. Very simple. All these results I'm telling you now are so simple to explain using magnetism that it's worth all the effort that we did before. If I have a triangle and I'm trying to put an antiferromagnetic interaction, of course it's frustrated because this guy will have a minus energy, this has a minus energy, and this has a plus energy, so I'm not gaining from here. On the other hand, if I have a ferromagnet, it's very happy, right? Not frustrated. So this, in the antiferromagnet, is frustrated, and this is not. So if I compared my XY term to my Ising term, XY is lying in the plane ferromagnetically. So the XY term will give me a lot of energy. It will give me JX minus JX S squared for every bond. Minus JX S squared, minus JX S squared. So I get here 3 times minus JX S squared for this energy. For an antiferromagnet, I get plus JZ, plus JZ, and unfortunately here, minus JZ S squared. But here I get a plus JZ S squared. So overall, I get only one times minus JZ S squared. This is E of a triangle, and here E of a triangle is minus 3 times JX S squared. So even if JX is much smaller than JZ, up to a factor of 3, this energy is lower than that energy because of lack of frustration. So imagine H is equal to zero, I'm sitting on a triangular lattice. Or other frustrated lattices could be the FCC in three dimensions, highly frustrated. Any lattice that involves triangles between its nearest neighbors is frustrated. The frustration essentially eliminates the effect of the Ising term, because the Ising term is highly frustrated, it's an antiferromagnet. So then, if I look at the phase diagram as a function of, in this case, mu, I just get a superconductor everywhere. Now, if I increase the size of Jz, eventually I might lose, and I say, okay, if Jz is so large that this is energy is still smaller than that, there will be some small region here of a charge density wave. But it will quickly go away as you put on the magnetic field or you put on the chemical potential. So you see here that frustration helps superconductivity and eliminates the charge density wave, which is the competing phase. Yeah. Right.
Would you mind explaining why one is frustrated and one is not?
Because you could not satisfy all the antiferromagnetic bonds and get the maximum energy by having each one of the bonds separately minimized, which you can here.
What do you mean by minimized?
This is the minimum energy of a bond, right? Minus Js squared. The two spins are exactly anti-aligned. If they're not anti-aligned, there will be some cosine theta here. So this bond being satisfied, this bond being satisfied, satisfied being minimum energy, makes this bond unsatisfied, maximum energy. That's frustration. Not everybody can have their cake and eat it, I don't know. Now, frustration is a much broader subject in physics, and anybody who went to my talk heard about the most frustrated model in physics, which is the Kagome lattice. Frustration also leads to a lot of very interesting quantum effects. But here I'm talking on a very basic level of trying to minimize energies with nearest neighbor bonds. And that result actually has very strong consequences. It means that you can have superconductors in a situation where the interactions are very strong. If you didn't have frustration, they would obviously turn into an insulator with charge disproportionation like this bio-bismutate does, but it avoids it because the lattice structure is, let's say, FCC. For instance, a good example of that situation is another high TC, relatively high temperature superconductor called Buckminster Fullerene. Anybody heard about that system? It's balls of carbon called C60 lying in a FCC structure. I don't draw three-dimensional structures very well, but it's highly frustrated, and the system, instead of turning into an insulator where you put more charge on one relative to the other, the charge gets distributed uniformly, and it's a superconductor. Okay? So there are examples of this also in nature. Now, this leads us to one very exotic topic that was discussed a lot in the literature of recent years, called supersolid. Anybody heard about supersolids?
I think it's recent, there's a paper saying it's falsified.
By the guy who found it, yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that it was falsified on the day he found it. But anyways, it took a long list of Nature and science publications until that conclusion was arrived. But the basic idea is actually an old idea by Michael Fisher, who suggested, based on this model that you learned just now, this minus X Z model, that there's a possibility to see a new phase of matter. And in fact, it's been observed, but not in helium. The problem was, is it observed in helium? In helium, it's not observed, I believe. But where it is observed is actually in electronic systems and also in cold atoms. A supersolid is a mixture of both charge density wave and superconducting order. In terms of spins, it's a very natural phase to write down. I just draw you the spins and you see immediately what a supersolid is. Supersolid is a situation where there's both modulation in the z direction and a component in the xy plane. For instance, let me draw this kind of situation. If I look at this and I interpret it in terms of charge, the charge is the z component. So the charge does this. If I look in terms of superconducting order, it's simply non-zero. So you have both the charge ordering, rho, or let's call it n, of q goes like cosine, some amplitude m of q cosine qx, both an alternation in space and superconductivity. Now, why is that so exotic? Because if you think about helium, and you say, well, there are two phases of helium. One is a superfluid, which we're going to discuss a lot. Superfluid is this kind of order. And one is solid. You have atom here, no atom here. Atom here, no atom here. And that's a solid. How can you have a solid and a superfluid at the same time? And the answer is, no problem here. The order parameters can live together if the Hamiltonian wants it to do. That's the big question. So the question in helium, the Hamiltonian, does it want the system to be in a supersolid phase or not? That's an open question that I think experimentally was answered to the negative, and theoretically was answered always to the negative because of calculations. But there's no reason that in other systems, for instance, in superconductors, you can't have coexistent charge density wave and superconductivity. In fact, there's lots of systems like niobium triselenide. Very good superconductor serves to make huge magnets. It has, there's niobium 310. There's materials which have superconductors and charge density wave at the same place. The charge gets modulated a little bit, but there's still all the parameter for this object. So where can you get it from the Hamiltonian? Well, one place you can get it is in a frustrated lattice. And I can now draw you, just before you go, just the phase diagram of the triangular lattice model. So you take the model I wrote down before. You put it on a triangular lattice. And this is H. This is now the spin model. This is JZ minus JX. At H equals zero, the system is, in a sense, at H equals zero, this is a system which is highly frustrated, but it's it has the following phase diagram. It look at large H, this is actually fully polarized. In the middle, in these kind of let's see, there's a it goes like this. Sorry. Okay, let me explain what these phases are. Here, you get a superconductor where all the spins are canted in the negative direction. Here is a superconductor, a superfluid. All the spins are like that. Here, you get an insulator where some more spins are up than down, and here's more spins down than up, but they're all pointing in the z direction. And between them, here, you get up, up, down, canted. And then here you get down, down, up, canted. So these are supersolids. It's just a balance between all these energies. It's there is some regime in phase space where when you put the magnetic field, the system would like to both be in the xy plane and also to have some staggered direction in the z direction because of the large jz. So this is a region well defined, found, also confirmed numerically for the model that I described before, h minus x z on triangular lattice. And it's actually one of those places where supersolidity can be verified numerically because you can use Monte Carlo simulations on this model with no minus sign problems. And in cold atoms, people look to realize it. So here you'll have a regime indeed that has both all the parameters. This, by the way, is a paper by two of my good friends and myself in FISREV B 55. So look under my name for FISREV B. And my collaborators are Dana Rovas and Ganapathy Murthy. So you see that there's possibilities of getting super solids in these models quite easily. And usually you need to do some frustration and you get it. So I think by this I finished discussing essentially for a while models of superconductivity and how to get essentially superconductivity out of interacting electrons. What I'll do next is I'll treat the phase that's most interesting, the superconducting phase itself, this phase, which is an XY phase where spins are in the plane, but I'll treat it using bosons. It's very convenient to use bosons there because the mathematics of using bosons is easier than the mathematics of using spins. Spins are constrained. They're operators that live in a small Hilbert space, and because of the constraints, the path integrals are nonlinear, and we saw some of the problems before. With bosons, we can actually have an easier time doing the analysis of what kind of phenomena you'd expect in a superconductor. The most important effect that I would like you to understand by the end of next week is why a superconductor has persistent currents. Okay? This is a concept that a lot of people with PhDs don't understand. It's a concept that is deeply tied to rigidity of wave functions, to things that we learned in quantum magnetism. But it's very difficult to explain if you start with fermions and their Green's functions and do Fermi liquid theory and perturbation theory. It's a non-perturbative idea that cannot be approached by weak coupling thoughts. So if you understand why a superconductor is a superconductor, I'm happy. That's as much as I wanted you to get from all this course. Okay? So we'll get to that next week.